Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this show is Scott Kellogg, who, along with his wife Stacy Pettigrew, operate the Radix Center in Albany, New York, and co-authored Toolbox for Sustainable City Living. That book brought Scott to my attention. My wife found it one night at the library and thought it would prove interesting with the urban work I was involved in at the time. Like Rachel Kaplan's book, Urban Homesteading, as I flipped through the pages of Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, I said to myself, this is a permaculture book. And I stopped flipping through it and actually began reading it in earnest. My suspicions proved correct. Toolbox for Sustainable City Living came out of Stacy and Scott's work in transforming a portion of Austin, Texas, into a more sustainable community by building working systems in an urban environment. Though the book led me to look up Scott as a guest for the show, his current work is why I asked him on. Scott and Stacy offer a course called RUST, Regenerative Urban Sustainability Training. It's a nice mix that takes the important parts of permaculture and adapts them to city living by stripping away the extraneous bits and packaging it up into something taught in a weekend. It's a new model for transmitting permaculture to those people who need it most, without the time or financial requirements of a full permaculture design course. Check out this interview and listen as we discuss Scott's background, the framework of RUST, and some considerations for moving sustainable design forward. If you like what you hear and want to take a class, contact Scott and Stacy to learn more. You can go visit them at the Radix Center in Albany, New York, or make arrangements for them to come to you. Whichever path you choose, their methods will empower you and your community. If you want to find out more about RUST or any of the other resources mentioned in this episode, visit thepermaculturepodcast.com. There you can leave a comment about this episode, and we'll find ways to connect with me, including email or the voicemail line, and how to follow the show on Facebook or Twitter. I hope you enjoy this time with Scott as much as I did. Now on to the interview. Why don't we begin this interview with a little bit of your background?
My name is Scott Kellogg. Currently, I'm living in Albany, New York with my wife, Stacy Pettigrew, and we have daughters, Ellie, who's 5, and Violet, 3. And we started a relatively new nonprofit organization up here in Albany that's called the Radix, R-A-D-I-X, which is just the Latin word for root, Radix Ecological Sustainability Center. Basically, what we're doing is building an urban environmental education center here in downtown Albany, where we have on display numerous ecological tools and technologies designed to teach primarily and not exclusively urban residents how to have more local access and control over essential resources like food, water and waste management, energy production, with an emphasis on designing systems that are simple and affordable, with the ultimate goal of coming up with a replicable model that can be copied throughout cities in the U.S. and the world as well. We're putting a lot of emphasis on developing models for what we call ecologically regenerative micro-industries. Basically, the idea if you can find a way to couple sustainable practices with an economic engine, then you can greatly increase the rate at which they're being implemented, A, and also B, addressing issues of economic uncertainty, which are really prevalent, particularly in inner city areas in the country. A need that you commonly hear is that for jobs and for employment. So we're interested to see, you know, is it possible to be making a living in the city by raising fish or raising mushrooms or collecting compost and growing vegetables, and ideally be using the byproducts of that small industry to do the work of ecological, social, and economic regeneration in urban environments, for instance, using compost to restore vitality to damaged, degraded, contaminated urban soils, and providing jobs for people at the same time. So that's what we're up to in Albany. We've got a big 20 by 60 foot bioshelter, which is sort of our main educational feature. It's been going on. We've been up here pretty much full time for the past 3 years. Prior to that, I lived in Austin, Texas for about 10 years, where I was co-founder of an organization called the Rhizome Collective, which ran from 2000 to 2009. The organization with actually pretty similar goals to what we're presently doing. We had an old warehouse space that we converted into what we call also a demonstration of urban sustainability, and it had also had the dual purpose of being a center for community organizing, where we provided low-rent space to a number of different social and activist organizations, including Food Not Bombs, that did food cleaning, a group called Inside Books, which supplied books to people incarcerated in the state of Texas. All combining that with a demonstration site where we had constructed wetlands and gardens and rainwater collections and wind turbines, brought in a real diverse cross-section.
The intention of showing how the connections between
social justice and ecological justice movements were necessarily connected, interconnected, and creating an interesting cross-pollinization of people and ideas in the process. So that pretty much, that's my background. My wife and I, we wrote a book published in 2008 by South End Press called Toolbox for Sustainable City Living, a do-it-yourself guide that was really a collection of a lot of what we learned down in that time in Austin. Yeah, that kind of sums up my background.
So then you guys were having a lot of success with the Rhizome Collective in Austin and then the resulting book because of the large number of techniques that you guys were presenting that you were really finding solutions for that urban environment.
Yeah, we put a lot of emphasis on doing this work in urban environments. Presently, the world's population of 7 billion plus people, out of all those people, more than 50% of them, for the first time in history, are living in urban environments. You might think this is a good thing or a bad thing. There's a lot of people who've moved to these environments by choice, and there's a lot who've moved not out of choice, but out of circumstance. But it is the reality, and if we're going to be looking towards the future and thinking about how to make a transition into a sustainable future, it's really critical we look at our urban environments and think about how they can be transformed, redesigned, so that they're capable of providing their residents with more of their own needs, but also being healthier places at the same time and being more socially just places as well. Sustainability, I believe, plays a key role in doing this work. Cities have a tendency nowadays to kind of act like resource vacuums where they're drawing in natural resources from land-based surrounding them and from foreign nations as well. And typically, chewing up those resources and expelling a toxic effluent. A lot of what we're interested in is trying to get them to function more like closed-loop systems, where we're producing not all of the food for urban residents. I don't think that's a realistic or be necessary goal to have cities be able to grow all their food for everybody who lives inside. But at least some, 20%, I think is a very realistic goal, and that's actually being met within a number of cities today. Producing growing food for the resources for the residents, but also processing their wastes internally as well. It's going to require a whole diversity of tactics to bring these changes about in on the timescale that's needed. Ultimately, it's going to involve, I believe, collaboration from people working on a grassroots level and also people and coming more from a top-down policy level, and ideally meeting somewhere in the middle. Our emphasis has been mostly to work with communities on a grassroots level and to try and empower people with tools, resources, and information about how to begin doing this work right away.
So your big model then would be to change the system so that instead of bringing everything in from the countryside and foreign countries into a city where it's then used and then disposed of perhaps in a dump nearby, which would take all the food waste and durable goods and hardware, and then the human waste then goes to a water treatment plant where it may or may not be fully treated and then dumped in as effluent and wastewater into a river, so that they're using technologies that can recycle and reuse those materials within the city productively?
That's certainly a big part of it. Let's give an example. The Rhizome Collective space that we had, when we first got there was just an enormous asphalt parking lot, burnt out building. One of the first things we did was to rip up all that asphalt, which was an incredibly joyful thing to participate in doing, feel that soil breathe and come back to life after being covered for decades by an impervious cover. And we managed to build gardens and small little agroforestry system inside of there. The way that we were able to build soil so quickly was by intercepting organic matter that would have otherwise gone to the landfill. In our case, that was wood chips that right around the corner from us, there was a tree mulching business, which every day would bring dump truck loads of wood mulch and throw it into the landfill. And when all that organic matter breaks down anaerobically, it produces methane, which is about 20 times more potent pound for pound is the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide is. About 3 to 6% of greenhouse gas emissions in this country come from landfills in the first place. But that all that organic matter is exactly the stuff we need to be intercepting. Composting aerobically surface the planet, turning into soil that we're going to be using to growing food for future urban residents, and at the same time addressing issues of food security and food deserts, improving people's access to healthy and nutritious food, which is also a major city, a major issue in inner city environments today, is the fact that many times it's difficult, if not impossible, for people to access healthy, nutritious, fresh food. The only places to buy food being corner markets, which only sell a lot of processed garbage. It all goes hand in hand, each other, teaching skills at the same time, especially for kids, for a lot of urban youth, for whom there's a major disconnect between food that they eat and where it actually comes from. It's really powerful for kids just to see a plant grow or to see a chicken and know that that's where an egg comes from, or see a beehive and know that's where honey comes from. You know, people talk a lot also about wanting to get kids more interested in the so-called STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And our belief is that a great way to do that is to see the synthesis of all those disciplines take place in the garden and to let kids see the application of all those ideas first to understand why they would want to be interested in studying them at all in the first place. So a lot of layers to it all.
There's a webpage that I'm going to include a link to in the show notes, and I don't know if you've seen it. It's from the USDA Economic Research Service. There's a map that they have that allows people to locate food deserts in the United States.
Yeah, and they're all urban. There's plenty of rural deserts as well.
It was one of the topics and issues here where I am in central Pennsylvania that was a surprise to me when I first heard the term of food desert. It was something very foreign. The numbers that were broken down to me is that the two locations where individuals in this urban environment can buy groceries, really go and be able to buy a full selection of food that's not just a grab-and-go corner market, is like 7 or 8 miles apart on either end of the city. So everyone who's located in the central city, which right now tends to be the lower income areas, those people who most need that healthy, readily available fresh food have the farthest to go to get it and the least means to do so.
Right. And especially if you don't own a car, it's really difficult to get to a lot of these grocery stores, which are located typically on the fringes of the city or many times out in the strip malls in the suburbs. You know, what a lot of people may resort to having to do is take a cab. And, you know, if you've got kids, forget it. Trying to take a cab out to a supermarket and load all the food in, for a lot of people, it's just not going to happen at all. So it's really important. And I believe this process may likely happen as a sort of a relocalization in general that occurs as a consequence of increasing food prices, where more businesses begin to relocate to the inner city centers. But it's not happening quickly enough. I mean, there is a current and present need for increased access to nutritious food. So this is, you know, this is something that we're seeing all across the country, all across the world, is an interest in urban farming altogether.
Is that what led you then from the Rhizome Collective and your earlier work to develop your RUST program?
The idea behind RUST, which stands for, it's an acronym, it stands for the Regenerative Urban Sustainability Training, was to look at sustainability and permaculture trainings and to attempt to distill them down, to take the aspects of, for instance, a permaculture training that were the most relevant to urban areas and focus exclusively upon them in an intensive weekend-long workshop. Nothing against traditional permaculture design courses, but, you know, for those that take place over a 14-day period, I know there's a lot of different innovations are out there where people can take them over the one weekend per month, over several months, but they're also fairly expensive, and that limits the number of people who are going to be able to take one, the accessibility of it. And for a lot of, you know, working people, lower-income urban residents, it's not practical for them, or possible for them to take a full-length PVC. So we sought to see, you know, is it possible to take, and also may not be necessary to learn about things like broad-scale forestry or agriculture, you know, large-scale farming, dam creation, earth moving. Not to say that those things aren't important, but there's limited opportunities to put those skills to use in an urban environment. And there's other aspects, there's other things that can be done in a city that maybe underemphasized within the traditional PDC. So our goal was to shorten length, to lower the price, to have it based on a sliding scale and have work trade and scholarship options available, and to concentrate just on those aspects of permaculture or sustainable design that were most relevant in the urban context. Being very careful at the same time to make clear that it is not a permaculture design course, which a lot of people, you know, might get upset about. Well, you're dumbed down for permaculture. Well, that's not what it's about. Nobody's coming away from it with a PhD certificate. It's just an attempt to make that information and those tools and those skills and that knowledge accessible to a broader range of people.
This is a completely separate training that has its roots and basis in permaculture, but it's not meant in any way to supplement for a full-length PDC if that's what someone is interested in.
It would be supplemental would be correct. However, not a there's probably a lot that you would learn in Rust that you would not learn in permaculture. For instance, we spent a lot of time talking about bioremediation, the use of naturally occurring organisms to degrade or to immobilize or sequester contaminants that are in the soil. That's something that's treated fairly peripherally in most permaculture design courses, and that's largely due to the fact that's not well understood. But it's something that's of particular importance to urban environments, as apart from gaining access to land, one of the biggest limiting factors to growing food in cities is the fact that soil is so commonly contaminated as a consequence of the past 150 years of industrial processes. I would say you could definitely be complementary to a permaculture course if you've already taken a PhD. But it also could be an introduction to permaculture for people who might not have otherwise been exposed to it. And I know at least of a couple of people who've taken a Rust training, gotten really excited about these ideas, and then from there have gone on to take full-length permaculture courses. Yeah, I would say it's complementary.
Whether you want to take a Rust as your only course, as your introduction to permaculture, or as a follow-up, there's an appropriate place for it in someone's urban training.
Yeah, we've been doing the class for 6 years now. The first one was in 2006. I believe we will be teaching, I think this one upcoming in September will be our 14th class. There have been over 600, 650 people who've attended it so far. Every time I teach it, it's a great experience. We're excited for this one in particular. This is the first one where we'll actually be using the Radix Center as a model. So we'll have lots of functioning examples of the systems that we're discussing in the class to be playing with.
Will that provide then hands-on workshop opportunities for the people who are there to interact with this?
Definitely. I'd like to do as much hands-on learning as possible. You know, some people are very good, learn well by listening, but I believe the majority of people learn much better by touching, by tasting, by smelling, by actually doing, by getting up and moving their body as much as possible. So I try and cater to different learning styles, but incorporate as much hands-on and physical activity as possible. It's a combination of lecture and hands-on format, and I keep the lecture to a minimum to sort of speak generally about concepts and theories, and then to immediately go out into actual urban neighborhoods to see what it looks like on the ground, so to say. You know, it's one thing to look at PowerPoint images of them, for instance, an aquaculture system, an aquaponics system, but so much more to actually go and see one in an actual urban neighborhood and to put your hands on it and to smell the water and have the fish splash water on your face, have that tactile learning as well. So it's very important.
You mentioned aquaponics, and you said that bioremediation is something that you focus on that differentiates the work that you're doing from a traditional PDC. What are the range of topics that someone would encounter by coming and taking this class with you?
Well, I break it down into general topics of food, waste, water, energy, bioremediation, which are actually correspond to the chapters in our book. We spend a good amount of time on food. We actually don't talk very much about straight up conventional gardening, and that's not because it is not important. It's simply that it's something that I feel is really well covered in a lot of other places. So we focus more on less conventional food production techniques, like, for instance, aquaponics, which is something that makes particular sense in an urban environment because it is such an intensive system. Well, you can be producing a number of calories in a very intensive space, relatively small space, that might not make a lot of sense. For instance, you owned a lot of land and you had a lake and a lot of property. There wouldn't be as much reason to actually be doing aquaponics there when you'd be growing plenty of fish in a big pond. But if all you have is an empty warehouse space with some south-facing windows, aquaponics certainly makes a lot of sense there. We also talk a lot about what I call micro-livestock, which are animals smaller than cows or sheep or goats or pigs, things like chickens, ducks, turkeys, rabbits, guinea pigs, animals that eat a lot less. They produce a lot fewer wastes. They don't smell as bad. They have much lighter impact on the ground. All these are factors that make them far more appropriate to raise in an urban environment. And we talk a lot about them, the practicalities of it. And another huge side of all this, too, is the legal aspect. Many of these sustainable systems may not be technically legal to implement in a variety of cities. So that's a huge aspect of all of this, is looking at codes and regulations and, you know, talking about, well, does it make sense to attempt to modify and change these laws, dismantle the legal barriers that may block the implementation of sustainable systems? Or is it make more sense just to, so to say, go under the radar and just try and have good relationships with the immediate neighbors? That's another big aspect, huge consideration to doing urban design.
And I appreciate that you brought that up, because I've been involved in various municipalities and areas around here just in the central Pennsylvania region. And we run into, in one area, to have a very large garden, you can get fined for weed ordinances if your neighbors find that your garden is a little messy. Composting toilets in many areas are straight up not a possibility. Raising chickens may not be covered by any livestock rules, but they're under pest and nuisance orders. And there are all kinds of places where these legal barriers and hurdles can be encountered, and just calling one city official who normally handles that side of it may not get you the right answer you need, because it's under someone else entirely.
Yeah, it could be under the jurisdiction of a highly bureaucratic county hall, has no interest in modifying their laws at all. And this is one of the biggest issues, you know, facing us, is that most people have enough to worry about with just putting food on the table for their families. They're not going to take the risk of getting into trouble with codes departments or with health departments in attempting to do some of these more experimental sustainable activities. And they may not even be experimental. They may be, like you said, things as basic as composting, keeping chickens, things that people have done for millennia. But there are municipalities which may have ordinances against, and it's a tremendous battle to attempt to modify these laws. A very important and noble form of activism. I mean, my one big success story was getting a composting toilet approved by the city of Austin. It took us about 6 years, and that's working with an environmental engineer in the process. It's a very important battle, because if you do manage to legalize these systems, you more or less paved the way. You created the precedent, and then other people can follow in behind you without having to do that type of work. What I would ultimately like to see, though, is instead of having each of these be one piecemeal in every single town or city, for there to be an urban, or not even necessarily urban, but something equivalent to right-to-farm laws for a certain other degree of sustainable practices, including things like keeping small livestock or composting toilets or composting or gray water systems, that could be adopted wholesale by municipalities, so that it doesn't have to be a battle for each particular thing in every single town. Because if that's what we have to do, we're not going to be able to implement these things on the near exponential level that they need to be implemented on. We're going to make a process of transition, if we're going to transition sustainability at the speed that we need.
So if there could be some kind of a blanket best practices, they could be put in the hands of those people who are trying to change these laws. They can just take them directly to their municipalities and say, this is what we have, this is what we know that works, here's some supporting documents that shows that these things are safe, here, just pass it, approve it, let us do this.
Exactly, as a whole package. And it could be comprised from best practice from cities and towns all over with them. For instance, New York City, in the past 2 years, has legalized keeping both chickens and beekeeping. And when I say, God, if it can be legal in New York City, it should be everywhere. You know, if people have any concerns about health and safety, population density, there's nowhere that anybody would be more concerned about those things than in New York City. So if it can happen there, my God, it should be happening everywhere else.
And maybe that's a place, as you say, to take their precedent, find copies of their laws that they're using to regulate this, and start disseminating it.
Exactly. Unfortunately, it's not always so simple, because you do have politics that love it, really like control. All I can say is that over time, it will all happen. You know, a great model for this is that there's an organization out in Oregon called Recode Portland, whose whole purpose is to alter the codes for the state and for the city, and to legalize sustainability. And one of the big success stories so far was coming up with a statewide code for gray water systems. I mean, that's great. I think if you have the aptitude and the stomach to work systematically and within the legislative system to bring about those sorts of changes, then by all means, I mean, that's fantastic, because you're going to see profound and broad scale changes occur when you're working on that level.
You are the third guest who I've spoken to that Recode, well, it was Recode Oregon, has come up in the conversation. And I've reached out to them to see if one of their members will come on and talk to me about what they've been doing to legalize all this and hear some firsthand accounts and stories from some people who are doing the work.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about what they're doing.
I hear stories like yours that are these disparate pieces that connect what one person here has done. And I know that my wife and I changed the local rules to allow chickens in our town. And that was just one phone call. And they're like, you know, this seems kind of silly that you need this amount of acreage for that few birds. We'll pass it. And then it's a year and a half later, we finally get a copy of what they passed. And it's completely useless for anyone who has less than the original acreage. We're going back and trying to change that again.
It's a headache of a process. I mean, I was part of a whole coalition of people here in Albany last year that attempted to modify Albany's ban on livestock to allow people to keep a whopping 5 chickens, and which would require them to get the approval of any property owner within 50 feet. And then it passed to the common council, but our mayor vetoed it. So that was terribly disappointing. We, as a nonprofit, there actually is a provision in that law that says that you can be permitted to keep livestock if they are for nonprofit and educational purposes. Which is exactly what we're doing. So Radix has gotten explicit permission from the city clerk to keep livestock. It doesn't specify what kind or how many, which is kind of funny. So far, we just have chickens and ducks and rabbits. But we see it as a huge part of our educational mission to show people that, hey, look, this does make sense. This can make sense in cities. And in fact, there's an enormous historical precedent for people keeping chickens in cities to feed them our wastes and to collect their egg and meat products and do it all as a closed loop system right here in the city. And that it's not going to destroy property values and it's not going to give everybody avian flu. And it's been just awesome this summer to have kids come by who've never in their lives seen or held a chicken and to have them come in and just pick one up and just to watch their eyes light up as they touch a chicken for the first time. That's tremendously rewarding.
What other work are you doing with your training for informing people how to handle waste and water in the urban environment?
Waste and water. We do a lot of education around composting. We actually have a compost business. It's one of the sort of income-earning aspects of our nonprofit organization, where we do essentially curbside compost pickup. We give people these little 2.5-gallon green buckets that every Wednesday, which is today, put out on the front stoop, and we go around and collect them, bring them down to our site, mix them with wood chips that we get for free from the city, and put them in static piles over 6 months, allow the worms and the bugs to eat them and turn them into fertilizer. Our particular site, it's typical of urban lots. The soil is thin and degraded, and the remedy on any of those circumstances is to apply as much compost as you can. And it's sort of the odd curse of cities that, you know, we do produce as much waste as we do. We're not happy about that, but that's the key to restoring the health, the biology, the ecological processes to urban soils is all that organic matter. So we're all about people composting, and that's what we'd like to emphasize. Number one, doing it at home. Composting needs to happen, whether that's in the backyard or whether that's a worm bin in your kitchen for people who don't have backyards. But for people who don't have the time, the space, the energy, we're offering this as a service. People who want to keep their food waste out of the land. Ultimately, I think it's the responsibility of municipalities to do. I'm actually currently part of a technical committee that works with NYSERDA to come up with a region-wide plan for waste management. And the huge thing that we're pushing for is sort of these community-scale, neighborhood-scale composting programs. It needs to happen on all those different levels. So that's one aspect of waste. Water, the Radix Center lot we currently have, we actually don't have city water. There's no water hookup on site, which is actually true for a lot of urban lots. They may have had water on them at one point, but the pipes have since been disused and rusted. And it's pretty expensive in some circumstances to actually bring water back. It would cost us, it's been estimated, about $5,000 to bring in city water to our site. So instead, we've invested in developing a rainwater collection system, which is great. And we have been more or less off the water grid, which I do wear a little bit as a badge of honor. Rainwater is dechlorinated, non-chlorinated water, which rainwater certainly is essential for so many of the different systems that we have at Radix. Everything from raising fish, the aquaponic systems, to producing biogas, compost tea, even organic gardening, where the goal is to culture healthy and diverse microbial populations of soil. All these require non-chlorinated water. Chlorine, which is added as a microbicide to municipal water, very effective for preventing outbreaks of cholera and typhoid. But it's also killing those microorganisms in your soil that you would otherwise be trying to culture. So teaching people about that, a lot of people just simply don't have that awareness. You know, we are a bacteriophobic society. It's terrified of dirt, germs, and we don't realize that our bodies are walking microbial ecosystems. And if we're just dumping antibiotics and microbicides into ourselves constantly, we're destroying that ecology, which is essential for our health and our well-being. Just trying to create that basic awareness among people is a huge part of it. And people also understand it from sort of an angle of empowerment, of, oh, wow, hey, this is cool. We are independent of the system. If you're collecting your own water, if you're growing your own food, a lot of people are out of work and are psyched to begin trying to grow their own food.
And that provides them relief and alternatives if they're ever in this situation again.
The way I look at it is no matter how bad things get in the economy, people always are going to have to. So you can be set up as a food producer either in a city or in near vicinity of cities. And this is one thing we really emphasize a lot is the interconnection between urban and what we call sort of peri-urban or near-urban rural areas. Then you're in a very good position because there's going to be constant demand for your food. And your transportation overhead is going to be vastly reduced, which, and we're watching this happen as we come against genuine supply and demand limitations and the availability of cheap petroleum resources. That's going to force transition, economic transition is going to favor economically the small-scale local producer. This is already starting to happen, and it's a trend that I believe is going to continue. So it's great to get started on this work right away.
Because anyone who's capable of this needs to begin the work, show people that it can function, get the government to start changing the laws so that it can be rolled out further, and just kind of get that snowball rolling down the hill, let it grow and spread so that it's a self-sustaining system.
Yeah. What I like to emphasize to people overall about, you know, sustainability and permaculture is that being a good environmentalist is not about sacrifice. And that's, at least growing up myself, you know, that's that to be a good environmentalist is about just giving things up, about, you know, humans were just inherently evil and bad, destructive creatures. And if I wanted to be a good environmentalist, the best thing I could do was be less of a human. You know, permaculture definitely has a different angle on it. It says, wow, humans can actually play benevolent roles in ecosystem creation, that it is possible to be meeting human needs while simultaneously increasing ecosystem health. And what I like to show people is that the process of transition is fun and joyous. It's exciting. It's not just about austerity and hardship and sacrifice, that you will experience enormous qualitative gains in your enjoyment of life. So many people are just caught up in the cycle of pursuing materialistic ambitions, buying junk and trying to fill in this huge black hole in their hearts. But, you know, if you just do something as simple as go outside and have a plot in the community garden, and get your hands in the soil, get out in the sun, get some extra, get some air, and start making connections with your neighborhood and neighbors and who they are, and it will just be so joyful that it will snowball. You won't want to stop. It's really important overall, you know, beyond just growing food, to create functioning demonstrations of sustainable systems. A lot of people, particularly bureaucrats and politicians, just have these very vague notions of what sustainability is. You know, people talk about LEED certification, you know, government incentives, this and that, recycling programs, sure. But none of that really touches them on a personal level when you start talking more about when you make the connections between sustainability, climate, and food, water, and what you eat and where it goes afterwards. People need to see that it's possible. They need to put their hands on it. They need to see that it's fun, that it doesn't stink, and that it's not just a bunch of hippie garbage, which are the lot of myths that are out there. And when people begin to see it, that's when it starts broad scale.
With some of the work that I've done here locally, I know one of the conversations is that you address early on is that you're showing that the work that you're doing and the models that you're developing are ones that provide economic benefits to the people who are practicing it and to the community, then obviously through taxes and other things. And that a lot of times when talking with government officials, that's kind of a key point where if you can show them, well, this is our study for what this business is going to be. It's going to provide one management job that's going to provide X number of dollars with three assistants underneath them that's going to be Y number of dollars per person, that when you start talking economic growth and jobs, that you can really sell the bureaucracy on that.
That's the kind of language that politicians and bureaucrats like to hear. I believe that in a world of limited and finite resources, you cannot have an economic system that is dependent upon perpetual expansion. It's simply not possible. I mean, it's very simple math. That's eventually going to implode upon itself. Yet, just as with everything, there needs to be a process of transition. While capitalism may ultimately not be sustainable, it is necessary, I believe, to go through a process where we're finding ways for people to be earning a living, making a living in the current economic system, while engaging in so-called sustainable activity. And yeah, I mean, that's simply just how our society is set up, is that survival is dependent upon income. It's very difficult to live completely outside of current economic system. So yeah, talking about things like dollars and job creation, if you want to get somebody's ear on a policy level, that's the kind of language you need to learn.
With all the work that you're doing of teaching this to others, do you ever travel and do workshops on the road for others? Or if someone wanted to invite you in to give a Rust training, would you be available for that? Or are you concentrating on the Radix Center for now?
No, I'm definitely available to travel other places. I've done workshops in a variety of places. A lot of times those are brief. A lot of times they're just 2-hour lectures. Yeah, I do longer length workshops all over the place. I've gone overseas a couple times. I've actually done 2 Rust trainings, interestingly enough, in Norway, a country that seems to more or less have escaped the worst impacts of the recession, and also being an incredibly oil-rich country, has been able to afford to bring me over. I'm definitely willing and interested to go to any place where people may be interested in sponsoring a Rust training.
I will certainly include your information in the notes so people can find you if they'd like to contact you and find more about that. One other side of that is, are you offering any kind of like a teacher training if someone wanted to come in and learn this program from you and replicate it elsewhere?
Definitely a possibility. I've never been approached and asked to do that, but my philosophy has been that very much a let's train the trainers approach to things. I mean, for instance, that's why we do person of color scholarships and so many of the work trade-offs, is to bring in diverse array of people and teach them this information that they can then go out and share it with their own kids. I guess because the training is only a 2-day training, it wouldn't be that difficult for someone to basically copy the curriculum, but I'd certainly be open to it.
I brought it up because it was something of interest to me because of, as you said in the beginning, we're now over 3.5 billion people are in cities. And I find that the short course that you've developed is more applicable to many of the environments that I've gone into. And especially, I, as much as I hate to say this, permaculture has kind of a gentrified middle class pejorative meaning to some of the folks who I talk to about sustainability who are not, I guess, if you will, involved in a lot of what's going on. Because, as you said, people who have the time and the income to go take a permaculture training are usually middle class or better, or they're someone who's just getting out of college and they're kind of in between that, like, pre-adult and adult life. So some of the more conservative areas that I'm in, there are some issues with how you present some of this material. But having a short course like this would be very useful for some of the areas that I encounter and the people who I work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so much about presentation and just kind of meeting people where they're at. And, you know, then it's that's why training the trainers is so important, because, yeah, I mean, as a person who grew up middle class and suburban myself, yeah, I've lived the majority of my adult life in urban environments, but I'm limited in my ability to relate to certain people culturally. So it's very important for other people who have more cultural similarities, if we really want to see this information go exponential, who's going to be simply just more effective than I will. So that's why, you know, I see a large part of my work is really just trying to connect people with information, resources, tools to assist this information in disseminating and spreading. Another word you mentioned there that is relevant to all this is that of gentrification is a big issue and something that we need to be looking at, particularly within the sustainability and permaculture movement, is the fact, typically very much as an unintended consequence, of doing work of building green space and sustainable systems within urban environments can have the effect of increasing property values and result in the displacement of long-term urban residents, which are many instances people of color and low-income residents. That's really, it's a huge can of worms. It's very difficult to address, particularly because there's no clear consensus about what to actually do about that. But it's nonetheless something, the most important thing, I think, is simply awareness of it, because it's something that a lot of people aren't clued into. But particularly as we move into a post-petroleum economy, and that's what we already see now, is a re-urbanization trend, where people are moving back into cities, as is a lot of people realizing that suburbia is an unsustainable system, that it's not only going to be realistic to be commuting
2 hours or more in and out of cities every day. A lot of people are going to be moving back into urban areas, and we need to ask ourselves, what impact is that going to have on the communities that have been in cities, particularly during the past 20 and 30 years? How to ensure that these communities are not displaced? The social justice aspect of it is something to be particularly mindful of. It's a tough issue. It's tough questions, but something that we need to look at head on.
And having that awareness at least provides us a place to start to have that conversation as we move ever forward with this need and desire to bring sustainable systems into the urban environment. And this conversation is a part of that. I thank you very much for your time and everything that we've covered. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
I don't think so. That was a lot. Thank you so much.
I thank you very much for your time and coming on to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.